Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Have we got a great docket for you today? First, is Lori Vallow coming home? Second, Ghislaine Maxwell? Hey, she's okay with the world knowing who those eight John Does are all of a sudden. We have a Mother of the Year contestant. I'm sure you're going to love her. Is $20 worth of weed really worth life without parole? Let me know. Does this guy's face say worth it? Taking one man's tragedy is another man's opportunity just a little too far. Then we have another example of why you don't take other people's things. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk. My name is Scott Reich. This is the most fact-driven, unbiased true crime channel. Now, first, hit that subscribe button. Go and do it right now. Go hit that subscribe button right now. And then while you're there, go over and hit that little bell. There you go. Hit the little bell so that you receive notifications of when we go live and we put up new content. Now remember, today is Tuesday, January 18th. Which means we're going live tonight, and we're going to have a special guest. Remember Mark Carlson, one of my investigators that I use? He's coming back because so many people enjoyed listening to our conversation, and we may do something, mix it up even just a little bit more. We'll let you know. All right, and remember, you can listen to Crime Talk by downloading us on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Just go to Crime Talk with Scott Reich. Download it, not only this episode, but all the episodes in the past. What would be better than, I don't know, taking my voice on a run with you? Maybe a nice walk in the park? Maybe to fall asleep to at night? Who knows? So you can either watch us or you can listen to us as well. But please do so. All right, let's get to the docket. As I said, Tuesday, January 18th. Is Lori Vallow coming home? Well, what do you mean by that, Scott? Does that mean she's going home? Well, not really. So the state hospital where Lori Vallow is currently being treated to have her competency restored has filed a report. And that report is a competency evaluation that's gone to the court. The attorneys, through the Attorney General's office there in Idaho, on behalf of the state hospital, asked that that report be sealed. And the court timely granted that order. So what does that mean? It means that the judge will get a copy of the competency evaluation, the prosecutors will get a copy of the competency evaluation, and Lori Vallow's attorney, Mr. Archibald, will get a copy of it. Mark Means will not get a copy of it because he is no longer an attorney on the case. So the question becomes, is she coming home? And what I mean, is she coming home back to the county jail, or is she going to remain at the state hospital? Well, we don't get a copy of the report. We won't know unless a couple things take place. One, we learn if she's being transported to her county jail. Second, if a court date is set for some sort of an advisement hearing. And obviously, if she remains at the state hospital, we won't hear anything. I'm betting on option three, state hospital. I just somehow have a hunch that she is not better and that she is not restored to competency. We'll just have to wait and see whether I'm right or maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Nobody knows other than the people that have seen that competency evaluation. We shall wait and see. All right, next on the docket, Ghislaine Maxwell. Okay, now, when this case started, everybody said, oh, you're pronouncing the name correctly. Listen, nobody knows how to pronounce her name because it's mispronounced or pronounced several different ways when you go to a YouTube channel or you go to a national news channel. They all pronounce it differently. So for those of you who say, Scott, you're mispronouncing Miss Ghislaine Maxwell's name or Miss Roberts, also known as possibly Jeffrey or Jeffrey, get over it, okay? Nobody knows how the hell to pronounce their name. And unless and until I hear them say it themselves, I'm going with my pronunciation. So there. All right. She no longer is putting up a fight to keep the names of the 8 John Doe's secret and will leave it up to the court to decide whether those names should be unsealed. That's right. Things are getting good. Now, the documents containing the names are connected in the 2015 defamation case brought by Virginia Roberts Giuffre, not Jeffrey, Giuffre. The case claimed that the man named Jeff was, well, that's right. We all know who the man named Jeff was, that guy right there, that he had, did that to her when she was a minor, and that Miss Maxwell was an obvious accomplice. Now, this case settled back in 2017, and Giuffre's attorney, Siegfried McCauley, had filed a brief last Wednesday arguing that the names be revealed. Now, generalized aversions, which is objections, to embarrassment and negativity that may come from being associated with this guy or Miss Maxwell is not enough to warrant a continued sealing of the information. Now, Mr. McCauley added, now that Maxwell's criminal trial has come and gone, there's little reason to retain protection over the vast swaths of information about that guy named Jeff and Maxwell's alleged trafficking operation that were originally filed under seal in this particular case. Now, this is the civil case. Remember that. Now, McCauley said that the court has already rejected similar arguments for anonymity, and the same standard should apply to the 8 John Does who still remain anonymous in court documents. Mr. McCauley added that at least 2 of the unidentified individuals, John Does, 53 and 54, number 53 and 54, respectively, do not oppose and do not generally object to their names being unsealed. So we'll find out who those people are more than likely, at least 50 and 54. Now, I'm sure there's some people that are going to object because they in no way want to be associated with that guy named Jeff in any way whatsoever. Why? Because he did terrible things to people. And why would you want to be associated with people that did that and to be associated with that guy? Not a good thing, for sure. So we'll have to wait and see. I think it's a little interesting that obviously Miss Maxwell had for years fought to have any of those names revealed. But now that she's been convicted and more than likely going to prison for a better part of the remainder of her life, if not the remainder of her life, and a lot of people didn't come to her defense, you'd think that maybe she's saying, the hell with it. It won't do her much good. She's not going to get a plea bargain by talking to the prosecutors at this point. It just simply doesn't matter. Hell has no fury like a woman scorned. Look out, John Does. You may have to get ready to be canceled. It's coming. Sounds like it. All right, next on the docket, Alec Murdoch. Now, the other day, I'm scrolling through. Some people are fascinated by the Alec Murdoch story, and I saw a comment. Somebody said, yeah, I just can't get into it. But let me tell you why I think this case is interesting, and then we'll get to the story regarding his bond, okay? So you have Alex Murdoch, who grew up in basically what could be described as silver spoon in his mouth. And for lack of a better term, this guy screwed it all up. He was so arrogant and so blatant at the things that he did because he thought that he was beyond reproach and that nobody could do anything to him in all of his legal matters. This is the ultimate fall from grace of somebody that literally had it all, was given to him, probably for lack of a better term, didn't really earn it whatsoever. It was given to him and had every door opened, every available opportunity availed to him, and he did it for his kids as well. For lack of a better term, he just pissed it all away. That's why I think this case is so interesting. The other thing is that he did not do this himself. There were so many other people involved, whether it was on the insurance fraud type of issue where adjusters may have been involved, bankers, no doubt. Then we had the people that were possibly victims, but were they really involved? And then the underbelly of the Lowcountry there in South Carolina, where Mr. Murdoch, one of the most respected people in the state, working for one of the most powerful law firms in the state, is associating with the complete underbelly. We're not talking about just representing them. We're talking getting deep down into the underbelly with them. So that's why I think this case is interesting. And let me tell you, after we talk about this story, why another thing I think is interesting. So it's been a week now, and Alex Murdoch's bond reduction hearing was held about a week ago. And Judge Allison Lee, well, she ruled against Mr. Murdoch's motion that he had filed regarding a bond reduction. And it was a simple order that the court put out. Basically says that he is a potential danger to himself and the community, and that he continues to be a flight risk. So therefore, Mr. Murdoch's $7 million bond with no option to pay just 10% is reasonable to assure his appearance in court. Now, the defense team had tried now five times to get their client out of jail since October. Why is that significant? Well, first of all, Mr. Murdoch has hired two of the most expensive attorneys in South Carolina for a man who claims to be indigent. That means broke, right? He's in custody. All of his assets has been seized, and yet he's hired some of the most expensive hired guns in South Carolina. And you have to wonder who is paying the bill, right? Are they doing it out of long-term friendship, just out of the goodness of their heart? I don't think so. Most attorneys don't operate that way because they say, well, I could do this for free, or I could be doing this for, well, money. Which one do you think the attorney's going to pick? That's right, the money, okay? So who's paying the bill? Is it somebody that maybe is associated with Mr. Murdoch, wants to make sure that he knows that he's being looked out for, and that that individual is maybe making sure that he doesn't say something that maybe implicates other people? We already know some very powerful and influential people have lost jobs as it relates to investigations regarding Mr. Alec Murdoch, particularly some bankers that he grew up with. And I think more and more are coming. I'm telling you, I think this story just has so many twists to it that we're all going to look back and say, how the hell could this have happened in a modern day era? How could there be so much corruption? I think we're all going to be a little bit surprised. Next on the docket, another Mother of the Year Award contestant, and we're still in January. So a 39-year-old woman was arrested after she allegedly faked her 12-year-old autistic son's death and left him in a motel room alone for several days. Now, a school resource officer from the New Providence Middle School in Clarksville, Tennessee, reached out to Vanessa Blanchard on October 29th because her son had not been in school. Makes sense, right? Now, Ms. Blanchard reportedly told school officials that her son had died after suffering a seizure 2 days prior. And teachers and administrators actually went so far as to raise money for funeral expenses. But when they tried to contact the funeral home, the employees informed the school that they didn't have any arrangements for the young boy. So the next thing to do is obviously contact Ms. Blanchard, who then allegedly said her son was still undergoing an autopsy at the hospital, hence the reason no funeral arrangements have yet been made. School investigators then learned that the boy's school-issued laptop was still active, and it was traced to the Vacation Motor Motel. Now, this was in Montgomery County there in Tennessee, and the sheriff sergeant went to the hotel and found the child alone in the room. Ms. Blanchard reportedly told investigators she had left her son in the motel room for about 2 weeks and checked upon him every other day. Now, Ms. Blanchard has been booked into the county jail on charges of contributing delinquency of a minor and false impression of death. What is it with people trying to fake the death of their children, or the children are just disappearing? Come on, people. They're children, for God's sakes. Pick on somebody your own size, not kids, man. They deserve to be protected. And if you don't want them, find arrangements for somebody that does, because there's somebody out there that will, in fact, take care of them. just breaks my heart. Next, $20 worth of weed, is that worth life without parole? Well, in some states it is. Now, as we talked about the 110-year sentence the other day regarding the truck driver here, where his sentence was commuted by the governor down to 10 years. Well, maybe the governor will step in on this particular case. So there's an individual, his name is Kevin O'Brien Allen, and he is now one of 4,100 Louisianans serving life without parole sentences. What you may have to consider, though, is Mr. Allen's crime was far from a bloody, violent crime. Yet he sold $20 of marijuana to a childhood friend. Allen and Justin Sheely were tight growing up in the parish in which they grew up in. But as they hit their 30s, Sheely was working as an informant for a local narcotics task force, and he recorded a pair of $10 pot sales inside a vehicle with Mr. Allen. Apparently, Mr. Allen wasn't as good as friends with Mr. Sheely as he thought. Well, agents booked Allen on two counts of marijuana distribution and prosecution, and the district attorney, Shuler Marvin's office, made him an offer of 5 years in prison if he pled guilty. Now, Allen was a father of two and had a steady job, but a handful of drug convictions, and he hesitated. Allen said he didn't think Sheely was going to testify against him because he was his best friend. His attorney should have told him, Mr. Sheely was not your best friend because he set you up. You're an idiot, all right? And he's going to testify because he doesn't want to go to jail, right? What have we said? The threat of imminent incarceration tends to break the bonds of loyalty. And let's face it, informants, confidential human sources, confidential informants, whatever the hell they call them this day and age, because they change the name all the time. It used to be confidential source, then it was confidential informant, then it was confidential human source, and I'm sure they'll come up with something else real soon. Okay, but people become informants because they got busted and they want to not go to jail. It's called three and you're free, right? Give me three busts and we'll let you go free. So the moral of the story is, needless to say, that Mr. Sheely helped convince a jury to convict Allen on both counts at his 2014 trial. Now, the judge sentenced him to two concurrent 10-year prison terms, but the Louisiana law allows prosecutors to increase a repeat offender sentence up to life. And in this case, District Attorney Marvin's office drew on Allen's past convictions, which was possession with intent to distribute marijuana back in 2004, marijuana possession in 2007, and in 2011, there was a methamphetamine possession as well as in 2013. Now, once invoked by the prosecutor, the habitual offender law gives little leeway to judges. That's like it is in most states. And most states save the habitual sentencing for the worst of the worst. Now, Allen pleaded that he was an addict and he never got any treatment. He was also turned down a second 20-year offer before the perfunctory habitual offender hearing. He turned that down. Guess what? Now Mr. Allen works in the prison kitchen making juice for pennies a day, serving a sentence that will end when he dies. Now, he's among nearly 300 people serving life without parole sentences in Louisiana prison based upon their status as a habitual offender. Current analysis shows that 40% of those cases, the incarcerated person is locked up for nonviolent crime. And now overall, Louisiana prosecutors have mostly aimed the law at black defendants like Mr. Allen. Black people make up 31% of Louisiana's population, but they're 66% of the state's prison population, and 73% of those serving life sentences, and 83% of those serving life as a habitual offender are black. Now, many other states have three strikes laws that give out increased punishments to repeat offenders, but Louisiana has long stood out for the terminal life sentences that can result when prosecutors drop the hammer. Well, let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen, this is not just a Louisiana issue. The habitual offender statutes should be there for the worst of the worst. We once had a prosecutor out here that said if you were eligible for the habitual, he charged them at sentencing. You knew that you could negotiate those down with a plea down the road, but it was kind of a warning. Other jurisdictions are a little more selective in that, and then they say, listen, I'm going to warn you. If you don't take the deal, I'm going to file the habitual counts against your client. You tell your client, you got to make a decision here, okay? Because well, the prosecutor doesn't even have to give notice that they're going to file them, but most of them do and say, I'm going to give you one last chance to save yourself. In this particular case, Mr. Allen obviously didn't listen to his attorney. I'm assuming his attorney said, you're going to be convicted. Your friend isn't your friend, and you're going to go to prison. Take the 20 years before they impose the habitual. Didn't do it. So sometimes people engage in what I refer to as felony math, right? 5 years is too much, but life is okay. We'll show them. Oh, yes, Mr. Allen did. Okay. Now, I don't think that these are, I do not believe that the habitual laws, at least in my experience, are necessarily abused. I think they do save them for the worst of the worst, where literally the district attorney says, this person has no redeeming qualities whatsoever and should not be walking among the population, usually violent criminals. Drug offenses, I'm not sure that that is appropriate. But maybe the Louisiana governor will step in like the Colorado governor did and reduce some of those, grant some clemency. Who knows? You may get a few votes out of it as well. Let me know what you think. Should the habitual be used more often, or is it overused? Let me know. All right. Now take a look at this guy. And before everybody leaves their comments, Scott, how could you say this? Are you saying that he should have run over his wife? No, I'm not. I am saying, look at this guy's face. Does his face say, worth it? I think it does. This Maryland man, Himanshu Magnal Tanna, he's 59 and he was arrested late Friday of last week and charged with the murder of his wife, Alka Himanshu Tanna. They apparently went to the Capital One Bank in Silver Springs, Maryland, and while attempting to cross the parking lot, she was struck by her husband's white Lexus SUV that was obviously being driven by him. The man allegedly struck the woman several times before colliding with a lamppost and totaling the vehicle. According to police statements, this was no accident. According to the police, when they arrived on the scene, cops said they took her husband into custody without incident and gave them a statement. Now, it's unclear exactly what he said in this statement, but I think if it's anything like his picture, it says, worth it. Now, I'm sure his wife was a lovely woman. Don't get mad at me, but look at the guy's face. Come on. Seriously, lighten up before you start hating on me, okay? Now, we've all heard the phrase, one man's tragedy is another man's opportunity. But I think this is taking it just a little too far. On Friday, California police arrested a squatter for illegally living in an elderly man's home who remains hospitalized for carbon monoxide poisoning that he'd suffered the previous month. Now, Jeffrey Goddard, he's 41, he had been living in this Claremont home for over a week when he was arrested. And while handcuffed, he allegedly said, it's all right, I'll be back. And the police were leading him to the police car. Now, the owner of the home is a guy by the name of John Mars, and he's 84. Now, he remains in the hospital suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning. Now, police were conducting a welfare check on December 20th when they found Mars' daughter, Lisa Mars, deceased from the carbon monoxide fumes. John Mars was found in the garage, which was filled with exhaust fumes from a running car. Goddard saw the incident on the news and thought, this is an opportunity. He figured that the home would be vacant for quite a while. He guessed correctly. And Mr. Goddard was spotted by neighbors changing the locks on the home soon after the carbon monoxide incident. A neighbor allegedly told police that he had confronted Goddard, who barked back and said that he has squatter's rights. Now, the neighbors contacted another relative of Mars who lives in Texas to inform him that there was an unwelcome house guest. And while illegally living in the home, Goddard paid the property taxes and put the utilities in his name. Now, Mr. Goddard has been charged with theft, burglary, battery, identity theft, and contracting without a license. He remains in custody on a $500,000 bond. So this is really, squatters are basically nothing but thieves. They teach you about this concept called adverse possession in law school. And if you're going to go take somebody's property, usually it has to be open, like saying, I'm here. Notorious, saying, here I am. I'm changing locks. I'm paying the taxes on it. And it's hostile. It goes against what other people should be doing to protect their property. Basically saying, here I am, kick me out if you want to, but you can't. That didn't quite work out for this guy, but that's basically what he was trying to do. he was trying to squat on the property so that usually in like 7 to 10 years, you can say, it's mine. I've been living here. I've been paying taxes on it. Nobody's kicked me out. Doesn't work. Never seen it work. They have old cases of way back when somebody was living on a piece of property in a corner of a piece of property out in the middle of nowhere. And they said, well, we just kind of settled. We built a house here and nobody said we couldn't. So we stayed here and we've been here for 20 years now. So I guess it's ours. Those are the old cases you read in law school. I'm not aware of any modern day adverse possession cases like that. Interesting, to say the least. Certainly an opportunist, Mr. Goddard was. Next, this is why we don't take other people's things, all right? A man allegedly stole a car in Ohio on Saturday afternoon without noticing that there was a passenger asleep in the back seat. The Findlay police contacted Tiffin police about a stolen white Audi headed to their city and informed them that there was a passenger asleep in the back seat. The passenger eventually woke up and was able to contact police and give them the stolen vehicle's location via text message. And just before 1:30 p.m., officers identified the stolen car and attempted to make a traffic stop. However, the driver, later identified as Justin Vaughn, failed to stop and continued to flee on the highway. The pursuit went over the county line, where the police say officers performed a slow-speed vehicle termination maneuver, ending the pursuit. The Seneca County Sheriff's deputies took Vaughn into custody, and now he's facing charges of felony aggravated robbery, kidnapping, theft of a motor vehicle, and fleeing and eluding police. The passenger was unharmed, thank goodness. But this just shows you, ladies and gentlemen, why you don't take other people's things. There could be people in the back seat, or somebody could get killed. I said this once, and I'll say it again, ladies and gentlemen. Don't take other people's stuff. That's their stuff that they worked for and they paid for with their money. And when you take their stuff, it's a crime. If you don't have permission to take it, it's a crime. I know that goes in LA, anything goes. You can take whatever you want from whomever you want and there's no consequences. But hopefully for the rest of the country, that's still the law. And finally, our dumb criminal of the day. And there's a reason why people say, man, that was dumb. Well, this is it. Officers in Florida received a call about a person cruising through the homeowner's property on a red side-by-side, some sort of like go-kart or something along those lines. Anyway, the driver, who was later identified as Joshua Shane Kreider, who allegedly approached a neighbor and asked him if he could use their electrical outlet, that's right, to change his ankle monitor. Are you kidding me? Anyway, Detective Pacheco responded to the calls. He approached Mr. Kreider, who was allegedly behaving strangely, and Kreider reached into his pocket and the detective said he heard a strange clicking noise. So he immediately handcuffed the suspect for officer safety reasons, and Detective Pacheco found a box cutter in his pocket with the blade out. Now, after a quick check of the side-by-side, it was determined that the off-road vehicle was reportedly stolen. Go figure. The detective ran a check on Kreider and found that he was on house arrest, but he has an extensive criminal history, which includes battery, burglary, and grand theft. Well, now he faces charges of more grand theft of a motor vehicle, resisting arrest. That's right, and they're both felonies. Good job on you. You are a dumb criminal contestant of the day, Mr. Kreider. You can't make this stuff up. Really, you're on house arrest, and they're going to know when you're out, but you're worried that your system may go down so that they know that you're not at home. Wow, Mr. Kreider, you are dumb and probably under the influence of some sort of illicit drugs. But today we'll just say you're dumb. All right, thanks for watching, ladies and gentlemen. Please join us this evening, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, for our live show. We will have a guest on this evening. Please join us. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.